Connecting our hearts to our minds when we think about climate.
Well, I've been thinking about climate change lately in really simple terms, that it's really about the people and the places we love. It isn't actually any more complex than that. So yes, we talk a lot about, you know, parts per million and all these degrees of warming and all these complex things. And they are indeed, you know, metrics that scientists use to talk about climate change. But if you just strip it all the way back, it is really about protecting those places that we love and the beautiful planet that we live on as well. When I started writing this book, at first I was sort of had my professional armor on and I started just writing a lot of the facts and figures, and I realized that this book was not going to be written in that way. I had to be real. I had to be honest about my emotional response, and I was hoping that by being honest, it would allow other people to start to connect emotionally to the content. So by allowing myself permission, I was hoping that would give other people permission to bring their own emotional response to this material. Because to pretend that we don't have an emotional response to the really confronting reality that we're facing right now is disingenuous. And I suppose as a scientist, if I can't be real about my emotional response, then how can we expect other people to do the same?
That's IPCC climate scientist Joelle Gerges. We spend the hour with her talking about her powerful and moving book, Humanity's Moment, A Climate Scientist's Case for Hope. It's about how she grapples with the grief her scientific findings confront her with, but also the hope she feels as she witnesses how the tide is turning toward climate protection. This is the last in our 2023 Earth Month series. Yes, it's May, but we couldn't pass up a chance to bring you this inspiring conversation. And this is Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. When climate scientist Joelle Gerges set out to work on the UN IPCC's sixth assessment report, the research she encountered kept her up at night. Through countless hours spent with the world's top scientists to piece together the latest global assessment of climate change, she realized that the impacts were occurring way faster than anyone had predicted. In her book, Humanity's Moment, Gerges takes us through the science in the IPCC report, explaining what it really means for our future, while sharing her personal reflections on bearing witness to the heartbreak of the climate emergency unfolding in real time. But this is not a lament. It's an inspiring reminder that human history is an endless tug of war for social justice. We are each part of an eternal evolutionary force that can transform our world. Gerges shows us that the solutions we need to live sustainably already exist. We just need the social movement and the political will to create a better world. Humanity's Moment is a climate scientist's guide to rekindling hope, and a call to action to restore our relationship with ourselves, each other, and our planet. Joelle Gerges is a climate scientist at the Australian National University. She was a lead author on the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or IPCC's, sixth assessment report, and she's also an advisor to the Climate Council, Australia's leading independent body, providing expert advice to the public on climate change and policy. In addition to Humanity's Moment, she's the author of Sunburnt Country, The Future and History of Climate Change in Australia. Joelle Gerges, welcome to Writer's Voice. Now, you worked on the sixth IPCC assessment, which came out this past year, I believe it was in 2022. The one that UN Secretary General Guterres said was code red for humanity. And you say that before becoming part of the IPCC process, you had managed to remain emotionally detached from the work you do. How was the IPCC process different so that you became emotionally involved, that it just became so real to you?
So I think that's a really good question. And I think many of us who are deeply involved in scientific research, you know, just get into the nuts and bolts of the types of problems that we look at in our own local areas, our regional areas. But when you have the opportunity to work at that UN level, it's really like having this giant jigsaw puzzle where you can see how your research fits in to the entire global picture. And I think for me, it really crystallized for me just how widespread and really rapid and rapidly accelerating the climate crisis really was. And I think when you zoom out and you have that perspective, which allows you to see how the trends you're experiencing in your own part of the world is sort of related to what's happening in other areas, for me was quite a shock in many ways. And maybe that sounds naive, but when you start to delve into climate science, it can be really overwhelming, and a lot of people do switch off because there's so much to take in. But really for me, it was that opportunity to work on that global level. And I was on the chapter that was dealing with water cycle changes, so changes in droughts and flood, extreme rainfall events, things like that. And the evidence was just so clear. So for me, it was really just having that opportunity to not just assess the scientific literature in my part of the world, it was also doing that for every part of the world. And I think that that was really the moment when I realized that the world is changing really rapidly. And I think that most people aren't fully aware of that, or they don't join the dots in their day-to-day thinking about climate change. And so for me, it was really that was really the moment where I felt like I started to need to speak out a lot more as someone who's deeply immersed in the science and wanting to share, I guess, the insights I'd gained from having that very privileged position of having a seat at the table.
Yes, and we accompany you on your journey through climate grief as you write this book as a result of the work that you did. And I have to say, it was grief that I can totally relate to. I felt that you were really expressing, you know, the obsession. It's never out of my mind what's happening to our world. It's a backdrop. And reading your book really helped me to understand that and how to confront it. You say that until we are prepared to be moved by the profoundly tragic ways that we treat the planet and each other, that our behavior will never change. So make that connection to why the emotional is so important in tackling this crisis.
Well, I've been thinking about climate change lately in really simple terms, that it's really about the people and the places we love. It isn't actually any more complex than that. So yes, we talk a lot about, you know, parts per million and all these, you know, degrees of warming and all these complex things. And they are indeed, you know, metrics that scientists use to talk about climate change. But if you just strip it all the way back, it is really about protecting those places that we love and our lifestyles and the beautiful planet that we live on as well. And I think for me, really, when I started writing this book, at first I sort of had my professional armor on and I started just writing a lot of the facts and figures. And I realized that this book was not going to be written in that way. I had to be real. I had to be honest about my emotional response. And I was hoping that by being honest, it would allow other people to start to connect emotionally to the content. So by allowing myself permission, I was hoping that would give other people permission to bring their own emotional response to this material. Because to pretend that we don't have an emotional response to the really confronting reality that we're facing right now is disingenuous. And I suppose as a scientist, if I can't be real about my emotional response, then how can we expect other people to do the same? So for me, it felt like writing Humanity's Moment was really my way of processing what I'd just been through with the IPCC process. It was this enormous life-changing experience for me. So not only was it a professional experience, it was very much a personal experience of really realizing that it's a one-way street. I could not go back to not knowing what I had just been exposed to. I couldn't put my head back in the sand in any sense, and I really had to move forward. So for me, I really felt that often people talk about science and, you know, there's this outdated notion that we have to be completely detached to be rational. And I believe you can be professional and logical and rational, but also be have an emotional response. So for me, that feels like a bit of an outdated way of thinking about the role of the scientist in our sort of modern society. And I think that we can entirely be professional, but, you know, I just don't think it's honest to pretend we don't have an emotional response. Because when I was talking to a lot of my colleagues, you know, you'd be having a coffee break and having a chat, and that's when you'd hear people's genuine response to the material that we were confronting in all these really intense meetings and throughout the course of working on the IPCC assessment. So, I mean, when you start to delve into the fact that we are witnessing this instability in the planetary system, and that we are already experiencing very serious climate impacts, how can you not have a response to that? I mean, if you didn't, it's almost like sociopathic to think that you couldn't be bearing witness to these really profound changes. And for me, as a scientist, I know that sometimes the language of science is difficult, and it can be alienating, and it can put up a lot of barriers for people to engage in the content. And that's why I wanted to use my own journey through the content of being an Australian, where we have this extraordinary country that people like David Attenborough say, you know, it's one of the most extraordinary places on the planet, and that we have more biodiversity here in Australia than some parts of, you know, we think about the Amazon or places like Papua New Guinea or Madagascar, all these exotic sounding places. Australia actually has diversity that's on par, if not exceeding those areas. So it's one of these places that is also on the front line of climate impact. So even though we're a developed nation, we have these developing nation vulnerabilities. And so as I was writing this book, all sorts of extremes were unfolding. And I suppose I was just joining the dots for myself in my own life and my community here in Australia. And it was a way of telling a story, which is, I'm sure other people around the world, other IPCC authors could tell their version of the story. But this was what was happening to me as an Australian scientist in my country, but also how did that fit into the global pattern? And in the book, it isn't just about Australia, of course, because the planet is connected. I do try and really document what's happening all over the world.
So let's talk a little bit about the process of the IPCC first. Scientists like yourself who put the assessment together aren't even paid, which I was surprised at. This is completely volunteer and a huge amount of work. But talk about the process of the IPCC assessment and how that consensus is created.
Good question. And yes, I think a lot of people are really shocked to hear that we volunteer our time. So many of us are, you know, professors at universities, and we run research groups, and we teach really large, you know, undergraduate courses and that sort of thing. And so that's all of our IPCC work is done on the top of our regular duties. And of course, just trying to have a life, our domestic life and that sort of thing. And of course, we were the group that dealt with the COVID-19 pandemic. So our process was really disrupted by, as you might imagine, you know, trying to have these UN meetings in all the different time zones was very, very, very difficult to try and switch that to online. And we did manage, but it often meant that we were repeating meetings in different hemispheres to be able to manage to be inclusive for everybody. So the IPCC process is really, it's extraordinary, firstly. It is really amazing. And, you know, governments of the world put forward nominations for different scientists to effectively represent their, you know, scientific community. And then there's a process that goes on in terms of people get selected based on their publication record and their expertise. And for Working Group 1, which deals with the physical science basis, that was the one I was involved in, about 240 scientists from all over the world. There are about a dozen Australian scientists. So as you might imagine, it is an equal geographic representation. Most people do come from Europe and North America. So Australia is sort of lumped in the Southwest Pacific category, which is kind of interesting. Anyway, and then we go through this very detailed process of assessing all the scientific literature. So it's all published material, and we sift through that material to try and get a sense of collectively what does the evidence base tell us? So not just one study that might be on the cutting edge, which might be emerging evidence. What does the weight of evidence actually suggest? And that's where we come into the uncertainty language. So we talk about things being, you know, highly certain or less certain. And so when you read the IPCC reports, you'll often see that uncertainty language peppered throughout the entire document. And that's because we're trying to be as accurate as we can be. So there are some statements that are based on quantitative probabilistic statements, and there are likelihood statements. So you'll often see numbers. So something might be 99% likely or 95% likely. And other statements are really just trying to give a sense of, you know, the overall body of evidence, and whether it's something is low confidence, high confidence, and so on. So there's qualitative and quantitative measures in place in that report. So as you might expect, that's a very, very detailed process. And it isn't just the group of scientists that gets to have a say in that. So it goes out to multiple rounds of review. So we develop a first order draft, and then that goes out to review, second order draft, and then we ended up with a final government draft. And so you have literally tens of thousands of comments for that report. So we have to take into account what different experts, different governments have to say about that content that we have produced. So you get this giant spreadsheet with all of these different comments, and then, you know, our coordinating lead author, so the leaders of the chapter, would say, oh, would you mind actually just addressing these sort of 300 comments by next week? So that sometimes was quite challenging if you're teaching courses and I was running a small research group. It was really hard. So then it's our way of really assessing the state of the knowledge at this point in time. And so some people say the IPCC is conservative, and in many ways it is, but it has to be by its very nature. If we are asking the governments of the world to effectively decarbonize our economies, it needs to be on very, very solid footing. And so, that's really the purpose of the IPCC, is to provide policy neutral advice to governments around what we know about the scientific basis. And so it is then up to the governments of the world to then take that into their regional context and decide what they're going to do about in terms of policy, development of policy. So, but the role of the IPCC is effectively to give, I suppose, that neutral assessment of the scientific basis, and then allow governments to make their own conclusions and I guess recommendations to how they go about shifting their economies and their societies as a result of that access to that information.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Joelle Gerges. She is a climate scientist, was a member of the 6th IPCC assessment, and her book is Humanity's Moment, A Climate Scientist's Case for Hope. Now, you talked about uncertainty, but one of the things that struck me was that low likelihood is based on the current state of scientific knowledge, and it doesn't mean that this isn't, whatever it is that's low certainty, isn't going to happen. You talk about low certainty, high impact events. And one of the things that's really struck me is it seems that the climate science is always catching up to reality, that the reality always seems to be much worse than what has been foreseen. So I wonder if you could talk about that notion of, you know, low certainty, high impact, and how that represents a point in time in the evolution of the climate science.
Yeah, there's a lot to mention on this particular point. So I think that it's true. The climate is changing really rapidly, and science is a slow-moving beast, right? So it takes on average at least sort of 6 to 12 months to publish a scientific paper. So for instance, if we see an extreme event play out like a hurricane or a wildfire, in terms of doing the attribution to what proportion of it was caused by climate change, what proportion of it is caused by natural variability, that's complex science and it really takes time. So I guess we're always going to be a little bit behind real time. That's just because the nature of science is that way. Although there have been efforts in recent years to do rapid event attribution, so doing that in real time or very close to that event, And that's the World Weather Attribution Group that's started at Oxford University in the UK. But getting back to your question, these low likelihood, high impact events, that's effectively the scientific community's way of saying that we acknowledge that there are non-linearities in the system. So the system can kind of veer off quite abruptly. And then you can end up in scenarios where there would be very high impact. So for instance, you know, say the shutting off of major ocean circulation, or you know, the collapse of particular ecosystems and the flow-on effects of that. And so I think it's really a good development that the IPCC has begun to acknowledge that and to actually deal with it specifically. So in our report, we do actually have these sections which tries to detail those types of events occurring and what those sorts of impacts would be like. But of course, because sometimes these areas are emerging areas of science, we have to be careful about how we convey that information to the public. But I think because of the potential for high impact, it is really important that we do warn the public, because it's not completely off the cards, but if it did happen, it would have major impacts. So I think that represents an advance in terms of the sixth assessment report from previous reports, which is acknowledging that we know that the climate system is moving really fast and that there are some changes that can be abrupt. So abrupt climate change was also a theme that was addressed by virtually every chapter of Working Group 1. And that is, again, a direct acknowledgement of the fact that we are seeing things unfold really rapidly. But getting back to what we were just talking about on the last question, sometimes that's kind of difficult because, you know, the science underpinning that is still emerging, or it's very regional. It might just be for a specific area. And so you can't necessarily extrapolate local or regional trends to the global scale. So that work takes time, and we have to do that work really carefully. But I do think that, say, for instance, in the seventh assessment report, there will be more on those sorts of events as we continue to improve our scientific basis that underpins that.
You talked about attribution. That is attribution that a certain event can be confidently linked to anthropogenic climate change, human-caused climate change. One of those was the heat wave in Canada and the Western United States. I mean, just unbelievable temperatures, 121 degrees. I mean, nobody saw this coming. Another one was the megafires in Australia, which you experienced. Talk about those fires and how you felt about them. I mean, what was going on for you?
Yeah, for me, part of the reason why I wrote this book is those events were unfolding as I was working on the IPCC report. And so it was very surreal. So I was shocked with that Canadian North American heat wave. Those numbers were extraordinary. So I do write about that in the book, because that had major impacts on people, on ecosystems. And to think that you can have that type of heat so far north, to me, was really off the map in terms of what we understand about the climate system. So to me, that was, a preview of what's to come. And then, of course, in Australia in 2019-2020, we had an extraordinary set of wildfires that actually broke global records for the sheer extent of the blazes. And as a result of those fires, we had our hottest and driest year in 2019, which was a bit of a double whammy, if you like, of really extreme, exceptionally dry and hot conditions. And then that led to the drying out of places like subtropical rainforests. So these areas that are usually lush and moist and covered in, you know, ferns and mosses started to dry out and burn. And for me, I live in northern New South Wales, which is an area of coastal Australia that sits in the subtropics. And for those areas, so for coastal areas to start drying out and for rainforests to become tinder was absolutely shocking to me. And in terms of the impacts of that event, the koala, so our most iconic mammal, is now on the endangered species list in parts of eastern Australia, which is again, extraordinary, not something I would have ever expected to see in my lifetime, that we could actually see our beloved koala become extinct in my lifetime. I think for me, that was a moment. And that came off the back as well of we'd seen mass bleaching of the Great Barrier Reef. So the Great Barrier Reef snakes 2,000 kilometres down the Australian coastline. It's the largest living organism on the planet. And we've seen 50% of it die off since 2015. And we're starting to see these mass bleaching events occurring even in relatively cool periods. So moving away from those historical connections that we would have seen in the past. So all these things were stacking up for me as an Australian scientist. And I started to feel grief around that and realizing that witnessing this sort of ecosystem collapse is not something that we're going to see, you know, in the middle of the century or the end of the century. We're seeing it right now. And I think, you know, you can read the scientific literature and just sort of go through it mechanically and have a look at the numbers and think about it. But for me, we were experiencing it right now, our beloved places. And I for that was really, I guess, the moment where I was starting to see places that I absolutely love burn. It made me realize that we have really left the safe harbor of what we understand about that sort of classical climate of Australia, or really the stability of the world's climate, and how that's playing out. So it wasn't just playing out in Australia, as you mentioned, it was also playing out in North America and Canada as well. And as we know, it's been happening all over the world. But for me, that was a moment when I really realized that if I don't speak out as an expert and try and sound the alarm, then I didn't sort of feel like I was doing the best job that I could. And I have the capacity to communicate and I have all this information at my fingertips. And I really felt like I wanted to share this with people, because ultimately when we're talking about climate change, you know, it isn't just about renewable energy and all this sort of thing. It's about our shared values, not only as individual communities, but collectively as the human race. What do we value? Do we value those places of ecological significance? Do we value cultural diversity? Are we okay that we're going to displace tens of millions of people from their homelands in low-lying areas of the world? And stopping to think about it from an ethical perspective. So for me, it's about those collective values that we share. And then as I started to write that part of the book, it took me into very, very different terrain. So this book takes you on that journey of realizing that it isn't just about the nuts and bolts and the numbers, and you don't necessarily have to be across all of that. Although it's good to know the basics and understand the extent and severity of the problem that we face. But I also really wanted readers to understand that there is so much that we can do collectively and that we must do. And I think that is a very different conversation to just the doom and gloom and, you know, the world is just going to hell in a handbasket and there's nothing we can do. The evidence does not bear that out. So one of the key messages from the IPCC report is how bad we let things get is still very much in our hands. So that level of global warming that we experience is still that collective decision, but we have to move very, very quickly. And I guess that was really the point of the book, is just realizing we're living through a profoundly historic moment in human history. And that's also why I called the book Humanity's Moment, because it's our moment to collectively reconnect with our sense of humanity, our shared sense of humanity, and really step up to this historic moment that we face and think, when I look back at the 2020s, where was I? What did I do? How did I contribute to the social movement that is genuinely sweeping the world at this stage? It's extraordinary when you start to think about what is actually happening and people are waking up and wanting to protect our world and wanting to live sustainably. And there are people who have been talking about these sorts of sustainability ideas for decades, right? But now we're facing a crisis. So it is a real moment. It is a real moment for us to step up. And when you think about it as being a transformative moment, then I think everything shifts. And I think that becomes a real motivating force in the present moment to do something about it. Whatever, how big or small your influence is, there's still something you can do.
climate scientist Joelle Gerges. Stay tuned for more of our conversation about her book, Humanity's Moment, after the break. That was The Professor and the Plant by Kevin MacLeod. And welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Go to writersvoice.net to find more great content, including web-only features like interview transcripts and extended interviews. We're spending the hour with climate scientist Joelle Gerges, talking about her book, Humanity's Moment, A Climate Scientist's Case for Hope. She was a lead author on the UN IPCC 6th Assessment Report that was released in 2022. That's the one UN Secretary Antonio Guterres called Code Red for Humanity. Just before the break, we were talking about living through the most critical moment in human history, when the people alive today, we literally hold the fate of the world and its future in our hands. It is a great burden, but it's also a great privilege, because there is still time for us to save all we love on this precious planet, our only home. I mean, I remember talking to Michael Mann about his book, The New Climate War, in which he talks about doomism as being part of the fossil fuel lobby, the fossil fuel industry's propaganda. You know, first they denied anything was happening, and then now they're saying it's too late to do anything about it. So talk about, first of all, what can we do about it? We have lost a lot. You know, what have we lost irretrievably, and what can we still save?
Yeah, really very good question. And I think just before answering that question, just to acknowledge Mike's contribution to the public debate, he's been extraordinary. He's been doing this for a very long time and trying to sound the alarm from that sort of from the scientific perspective. And I think that he's done so much in terms of the public conversation. I just want to acknowledge Mike for his incredible work, and he's been an inspiration to me. And I think that he really does identify this whole concept of doomism and there's nothing we can do, I think is the most unhelpful way of thinking about things right now. But coming to your question about what have we lost? Now, unfortunately, there is a certain degree of warming that is already locked into the system because of historical emissions. So the burning of fossil fuels from the past is still moving through the system and will cause a certain degree of warming. So we know from all the different model scenarios that are assessed in the latest IPCC report that we're going to breach that 1.5 degrees Celsius of warming in the early 2030s. So that is just around the corner. And what that means, for example, we were talking about coral reef ecosystems just now. That means the loss of between 70 and 90% of coral reef ecosystems. That's giant. And if you stop and you think that about 25% of all marine life has some form, some part of its life cycle in those ecosystems, then you start to see the cascade throughout these life cycles. And then, of course, the profound changes culturally to places like the Pacific Islands, the Caribbean, are the areas where people are deeply connected to those sorts of systems. And then as well, we start to see, for instance, those wildfires that we experience in Australia start to become average around about that sort of level of warming. And then we start to see, you know, that become, so what was extreme in the previous climate starts to become more normal as we start to see the whole planet warm. And I think that's a fairly terrifying prospect, that we are really starting to see uncontrollable wildfires that just can't be contained. And I've spoken to, you know, firefighters here in Australia who have been in the industry for 30, 40 years, very senior people, fire commissioners who are very, very experienced. And they said that with the fires here, they just couldn't fight them. They were so dangerous in places. So in terms of what we have lost, you know, I think there are definitely ecosystems like our coral reef ecosystems, also some areas, mountain areas, the glaciers of the world are really rapidly diminishing. And even in this last season, we've seen in places like Switzerland, they have seen a step jump, like a really abrupt change in their level of melt in those sorts of places in the European Alps. And that has flow-on effects, you know, for things like water availability, you know, the water that's available to for ecological systems and so forth. And then, of course, it's the flow-on effects of when those glaciers melt, and also the sea, when it's warm, it expands. We see sea level rise, so we start to see the displacement of many low-lying communities. And even already, we've got 250 million people living on land that's less than 2 meters above sea level. So we're talking about a lot of people being displaced potentially from that type of, from those impacts. And even the IPCC says that around 1 billion people are living in low-lying areas and small islands, and they'll be at risk from things like storm surge as early as the 2050s. And we're talking, they're very, very large numbers that we're talking about here. And so the biggest thing that I think anyone can do right now is firstly recognize that they're living through the most profound moment in human history. And I don't say that lightly. And I trust me, as a scientist, I'm not flippant with my words. I'm very careful with my words. But trying to avoid the destabilization of the Earth's planetary system is the most important thing that we're ever going to face as a planet, because once we tip the system in a particular way, as I mentioned, it's a very slow-moving system, so it will take millennia. So once we set in train, say sea level rise, that plays out for hundreds and if not thousands of years until that finds its new equilibrium. And so we're talking about a transformed Earth at that point. But the good news is that some of the latest modelling basically shows that once you start to reduce emissions, that global temperature starts to stabilise as well. So that actually is really good news. So that means that once we actually take this really seriously, the Earth system will respond. So as I mentioned, there will be elements that do play out, because it's sort of, there is irreversibility in some impacts, and I talk about those impacts in the book, and there's a lot to cover there, so I won't cover it here, but it's really just to say that we already are impacted by historical emissions, but the system will respond once we start to reduce emissions and start to really start to lock up carbon. And that is exciting to me, because it basically means that we can avert the worst aspects of climate change. And unfortunately, things will get worse before they get better, because our collective ambition around emissions reductions is still not where it needs to be. Right now, currently implemented policies see us warm between 2 and 4 degrees Celsius. So that is a sort of a catastrophic level of warming. We want to avoid that. And the IPCC is effectively a how-to guidebook to avoid that. And so everything we need is at our fingertips. We can get some of these really rapid reductions in our emissions from existing technologies, so we don't need to wait for the carbon capture and storage and all these other technological solutions. We can already do it with the low-hanging fruit of our renewable energy system efficiencies as well, so just doing things in a more efficient way, and, of course, restoring our ecosystems and trying to reverse land degradation in terms of locking up carbon back into our ecosystem. So that's a win-win. You end up restoring ecosystems and also providing habitat for the world's creatures to repopulate and to rewild these areas. And I think that's also really empowering for people to realize that whatever we do on that local scale does actually funnel up to create a global impact. So again, these are a very old, you know, sustainability notions of act local, you know, think local, act, sorry, what is it again? It's act, think global, act local, right? And I think that is a really nice guiding principle to think about, because climate change can be such an overwhelming concept for many, many people. And I know that people switch off because they're trying to take their kids to school. They're trying to deal with just the basics of living. And then to take on the reality of a destabilizing world is a really hard thing. But in countries like the US or Australia or places like Europe, we must, because many of us have the privilege of a roof over our head and the ability to make change. Even with the limited resources or social influence we might have, we can still do something collectively. And I think when we band together collectively, it's extraordinary. And that was the other thing that I loved researching in my book, is that this is nothing new. So the social movement we need to turn this around, we have those tools. So if you stop and you think about, you know, the social movements for civil rights or gender equality and things like that, I mean, not to say it's ever a done deal. It's a tug of war for social justice that is endless. But which side of history do you want to be on? And that's what I've been saying to people lately. You can be part of the group of people that tried, that really tried. You did everything you could. And it'll be two steps forward and one step back, and maybe three steps forward and one step back. But we're going to inch our way forward. And the other thing that I found really interesting is that you only need about 25% of a population to shift the social norm. So that means that everybody else ends up coming with that sort of engaged population, but it's only 25%. That's not huge. That's actually achievable. So that to me is very encouraging, because sometimes we think, oh, we need everyone to understand this. Well, maybe not. Maybe not everyone has the capacity or the bandwidth or whatever it might be to be able to fully grasp the gravity of the moment we're in, but there certainly is enough of awareness out there in populations that can really significantly influence the course of history to make those changes. And I think that's actually really inspiring.
And yet we have the cold, dead hand of the fossil fuel industry that is gripping and has taken over our governments, our political leaders. That is the fear that I have. We have so little time and their power is so great. So before we get back to, and I think it's so important in your book, Joelle Gergis, in Humanity's Moment, it's so important to highlight all the different ways in which the mood is shifting among the world's peoples. Let's talk about, you know, for example, the next COP, the next Conference of Parties, is going to be in the United Arab Emirates, a petrostate. The president of the UAE called the oil and gas we have is among the least carbon intensive in the world. I mean, about the most absurd statement I can imagine. And you know, there were more fossil fuel lobbyists, as you point out in the book, at the last COP than there were climate, you know, people who were climate protectors. So how do we shift that? What is your sense of having been part of that whole process of what we can do?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, in my book, I do make that point that at COP26, which was in Glasgow, that there were more fossil fuel representatives than other delegates. They were the largest delegate there, which shocked me in many ways, to think that there's people that really just want to exploit fossil fuels to the bitter end. And then you see people like from the Pacific Island nations who are literally talking about an existential crisis for their people, having to move their populations inland and their ancestral graves away from the coastline because they're literally being washed away in king tides. And this is happening right now in those parts of the world and parts of Northern Australia as well and other areas. So as an Australian scientist, as an Australian scientist, I think I've thought about this quite deeply, because We are the largest exporter of coal and liquefied natural gas. We have enormous fossil fuel reserves, and that's why we've been such a holdout on the global stage in terms of wanting to meaningfully reduce our emissions. So in the book, I actually talk about our own journey as Australians. As we had this federal election where we had this government that really wanted to continue to exploit fossil fuels to the bitter end, despite the reef, you know, despite the fact that the reef is dying and we're seeing, you know, really large-scale impacts in our country. But then it's all about removing the social license for these types of values to be represented at our very highest political level. And so that comes back down to the influence that we have as individuals to basically vote in or out people that reflect our cultural values. So that goes all the way down from the local to the state to the federal level in terms of who do we want representing our values. And that's also a very active debate in the US as well. But what was really extraordinary is that we shifted. We actually threw that government out. It was what they termed a climate election. It was a landslide. People said enough is enough. Ordinary Australians do not want to be part of the destruction of our beautiful country and our beautiful world. And we want to do things differently. And we basically said enough is enough. And I think that brought me to tears as I was actually writing during that period and the election results were coming through and I was wondering what's going to happen. And it made me realize that all of those individual voters going out to vote for their local candidate ended up culminating in this extraordinary victory for a better world. And now we're actually, as Australians, we now have a better target in terms of emission reductions, but there are still major forces at play in this country around the continued exploitation, particularly of gas reserves. And so, again, as I was saying before, the battle isn't won, but it's shifted the needle in a different direction, and then we can start to have very different types of conversations. And I've been having conversations with really senior members of the federal government around what we do at this moment. So if we can start to shift the conversation away from doing things the way we've always done them, which is, you know, the exploitation of fossil fuels, into thinking about this clean energy revolution, and ways that we can invigorate local communities and also ecosystems, and that being a very regenerative narrative rather than this destructive doomism, everything's collapsing, all that sort of thing. So I feel like this is where the individual comes in. If enough of us wake up to the reality that we still have very significant battles to fight, in this coming decade particularly, and we call this the critical decade because this is really when we need to see emissions halved by 2030 and really be at net zero no later than 2050 is what the IPCC says. So to really try and avert the worst aspects of climate change and to try and limit warming to those Paris Agreement targets, which is less than 2 degrees Celsius. So there's many things we can do, and it's an astute point you make about the continued exploitation of fossil fuels and people wanting to basically continue that industry. But I also talk to people from the business sector, finance sector, all over the place who really want to do things differently now. So I think enough people are waking up in different parts of the world and different sectors that really want to change. And as consumers, we can also think about where we put our money in terms of, you know, our pension funds or our you know, also thinking about our individual consumption of how we generate our electricity, how we move ourselves around in terms of transport, and also what we put on our plate. Meat's a very, very intensive industry in terms of its emissions and also its impact on the natural environment. So you don't necessarily have to become a vegan, but at least a low meat diet and thinking about those sorts of individual changes that you can make, which is huge. And with all of those sorts of things, you end up, again, in a really different place. And if you stop and think about us all doing that, the kind of cumulative impact that we can have is extraordinary.
You also say we need a cultural shift, which is really what you're talking about, away from the culture of uncare, also the culture of distraction. which keeps us silent, keeps us not talking about it. Talk about what we, our listeners, myself, the world, what we can do to break the silence, not just vote, but more than that, to really transform ourselves from I call it a culture of solidarity, because in this country, mm-hmm. We have moved so far away. It's a culture of suicidal selfishness.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's true. I mean, we are living in this extraordinary moment where we've never had so many distractions. Young people have, and all people really, but I guess I have access to a lot of younger people because I teach at a university, but just the fractured attention span, a lot of them have grown up just as digital natives, they're online all the time, and there's a lot vying for their attention. So in terms of what we can do as individuals that is outside of just, say, the voting and that sort of thing, it's also having genuine conversations about climate change and making that connection between what we're experiencing out there in the world right now and the reality of the science of climate change, and realizing that we're living through this profound moment in human history. So I personally think that just that awareness that we are, the people alive today will effectively determine the future stability of this planet. If you stop and really absorb that and what that means, it's profound. So it isn't the time for us to be, tuning out and zoning out from the conversation. It's a time for us to be saying, these are my values, and being really upfront about the fact that we care. You talked about the culture of uncare, and I think that's so true. And it's a tragic severing from the natural world, and many people aren't connected. But most people have pets and they care about creatures and these sorts of things. But many of us do live in, urbanized environments and are quite disconnected from the natural world. And I think that reconnection is really, really important in terms of understanding that we are just another species on this planet, and we're actually overrunning the earth now, to the point of it being that I think it's less than 3% of ecosystems are considered ecologically intact. When I came across that statistic, I wept, actually, to stop and think that we have done such damage to this world, and that 75% of the Earth's surface has been, altered in some way by human activity. I mean, it's just, it's heartbreaking. So the question would be to the individual, are you okay with that? Do you actually feel okay about that ethically, morally, spiritually, however you think about these things, professionally even? Is there something you can do in your professional life or in your personal life to make a difference? And that's why I also put a special call out to the creative arts sector. So I just briefly wanted to talk about that, because if you stop and think about it, it's often, we talked earlier about this, making this emotional connection. So if you stop and think about the Vietnam War, wasn't it that series of those photos of the napalm bombing and the little girl running from this devastated landscape, where people understood, here is the human face of war, right? It became a visual image that had a visceral response to people, and then it became intolerable. It became intolerable to bear witness and say, I'm going to step away from that. I'm actually okay with this, and I'm going to ignore it. And this is where I feel that our creatives can really help us make that emotional connection between what we're experiencing right now and also our ability to influence the present moment. So for me, thinking about how our creatives, so our musicians, our writers, our artists, our performing artists, all those sorts of places that we go as humans to find solace in the fact that human nature can be good and can be beautiful and can be creative. And I think that is, for me, part of the missing link, because unless we make that emotional connection, so for some people it might be a song, or as in the example I just gave, it could be a photograph or something that visually connects them, I think that's going to be the way forward for a lot of people. And right now, unfortunately, or it's just what's happened, that the conversation can sometimes be very focused on really technological discussions about, renewable energy policy and technical things that doesn't always engage people. And I think if we have a more inclusive conversation that really helps with that cultural shift that we need to, you know, either remove or provide the social license for these, for say renewable energy or for fossil fuels to be continued to be exploited. That comes down to our cultural values. And that's a shared collective thing that we all can influence. So whether that's through your social media, whether that's through your professional networks, whether that's through, there are so many different things that I could say about this, but I devote a whole section of the book to this because I think for me it's a bit of a missing link, because sometimes when you're faced with the harshness of the climate crisis that we face, it can be really overwhelming. And I talk about my own depression, my own struggle with that. But it's also that I find solace in the beauty of the natural world, but also in the beauty of art, how sometimes just being able to escape into beautiful human creativity is a really wonderful thing. And it's a reminder that as humans, we have, you know, extraordinary potential to either be very destructive or also really creative. And we can create a completely different world if we want to, but we have to be able to imagine it. And that's where our beautiful creatives come in, because they are our most imaginative, sensitive souls who will help us think about what does a future beyond what we can see right now look like. So whether you're a fiction writer and you think about what the future might be like and write short stories or a novel or something like that, or an artist who might just have a way of capturing something that we can't express in words. As a writer, I try to express my own sort of feelings in written words, but other, you know, pictures, you know, there's 1,000 words. And so I think it's about using visual imagery. And I also find film an incredibly powerful medium for a lot of people. So I've tried to help filmmakers out where I can, but there are so many different ways of doing this. So it's coming down to changing our cultural values wherever we live, whether it's on that local scale or that federal scale. And I think that that's really exciting, because that's something we can do. Because if we can say enough is enough, we want to do life differently now on the planet, because the stakes are just so high now. So I think we've, unfortunately, we've run out of time in terms of delaying the action that we need. But the good news is that we have an entire history that is littered with examples of the fact that we can do this. And so that was part of the book I really enjoyed writing, because, you know, I was able to read brilliant writers like Rebecca Solnit and her wisdom, her infinite wisdom, in realizing that, again, it's the social movement that's going to change this. It's not even a scientific discussion at that point, because trust me, you don't want a bunch of nerdy scientists leading the social movement. We're not going to do that, right? It's going to come from our cultural leaders. It's going to come from people showing us a different way of being in the world right now.
Don't put down the scientists. You're one of them. This is one of the most moving. It is the most moving book that I have read about the climate crisis. This really cut me down to the core there about connecting the human, the emotion, the grief, and the joy of where we can go. Joelle Gergis, Humanity's Moment, A Climate Scientist Case for Hope. It is just such an important book, and thank you for talking with us about it.
Thank you. It's my absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Joelle Gergis was a lead author on the UN IPCC Sixth Assessment Report that was released in 2022. Her book, Humanity's Moment, is out from Island Press. Go to writersvoice.net to read an excerpt. And next week, we talk with Elon Stavins about the people's tongue, Americans, and the English language. Don't miss it. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.